Welcome to the Mental Training Lab. I'm Pete Kadushin, your host, and my job is to have fun conversations that leave you with actionable tools, little experiments that will help you improve your mindset and mental skills so that you can do the things you love at a higher level. Welcome back to part two of the first ever Mental Training Lab reverse interview. After Jean dropped by the show to share her experience as a musician, we realized that there was a ton of ground we didn't cover. So today, in part two, we're switching seats and she's going to interview me. In part one, we covered a ton of ground, particularly as it relates to flow and creating the right conditions for both practice and performance. Today in part two, we start with an analysis of how and why redefining success in concrete, achievable terms is so powerful. And then we zoom in on the power of breathing, why you want to simulate stress leading up to big performances, and how outside factors like booze and caffeine can affect our performance. Jean does an excellent job of keeping me on my toes and getting concrete action steps out of me. So go ahead and buckle up for round two. Here we go. Well, and the trap that you run into, and this is common for performers of all sorts who aspire to be excellent, is that you get frustrated because you didn't have clear marching orders, so you didn't know your next step. And then you immediately start to predict the future based on what happened today. Then we're trying to like read the crystal ball and we go, well, everything's ruined. So that vision that I have out there, I don't think I have access to that vision anymore. I don't think I can get there. And so you get a little more discouraged, but then you say, you know what? But it's still something I want. So I'm going to just try harder tomorrow. And it's over time, just continuing to groove that, well, I don't know exactly how I'm getting better. I'm frustrated because, and over and over and over and over again. And I think that, you know, what you're pointing to is if, you know, most of us have the experience now of hopping in a car, turning on the GPS. Right? What do you give it? You give it a destination. You got to know where you want to go before you can get there, at least on purpose. But the thing that the GPS gives you next is just the next step, right? You can't absorb all of the information. You might check the route in advance to say, okay, well, do I want to go that way? And then you might say, you know what? I don't want to go on toll routes. Let me choose something different. Let me approach it from a qualitatively different standpoint, but we still have that end goal in mind. But when it comes down to actually making progress, you only get the next turn. And so it's important to check the path every once in a while to make sure that you're aimed in the right direction. One, right? Is the vision still compelling? Is that destination someplace I want to go? And the answer sometimes is no. Let's change that up. But you also want to recognize, am I getting there in a sustainable way? Do I like the process of the path? And then maybe you need to switch that up, but it all has to come back to, where's my next turn? What exit am I getting off of? How am I making progress towards that destination today? Because if I can't turn it into what's my very next step, then I've either got an ineffective vision or I have an ineffective process of turning that vision into concrete action steps.
That's a really awesome analogy. It's so applicable, and I'm definitely going to steal it.
Please do.
Can I switch gears and ask a question that I've been really excited to ask that does not directly relate?
Well, look, it's your show today, so let's go.
I mean, it doesn't relate, but it also relates to literally everything we ever do as humans, and that is breath and how much you think about it. I personally have overthought, underthought, jumped through every hoop that is available when it comes to efficient breathing, for psychological purposes, for functional purpose, and also the muscles that I use while I breathe, and realizing how my state of mind deeply affects the muscle tension as I breathe to do the work that I need to do. And so I think about the breath in so many different ways, and I'm wondering how you approach this beast of a concept.
Well, the sweet irony of it is that we're all breathing right now, at least I hope. And so it's something that we're so intimately connected to. I was about to say familiar, but many of us are not familiar with the experience, even though it's happening roughly 18 times a minute for most of us at rest. And maybe it'd be useful if you're still listening to just check in with your breath right now. And you don't need to do anything different with it, and although you'll feel the urge to do something different. But you can just notice, is it happening in your chest, right? Is your chest expanding, your shoulders coming up? Is it happening in your belly? Do you feel that umbrella muscle, the diaphragm that kind of connects right at the base of the ribs all the way around 360 degrees? Is that the thing that's driving the breath? Breathing through your nose? Are you breathing through your mouth? And in checking in, it comes back to some of that embodiment of starting to build a physical language. I really think about it as literacy. If I don't have the words to put to my experience of breathing, it's really hard to then build any sort of intelligence, and intelligence is required for fitness. I've thought a lot about breathing. And the reason why I've thought just a ton and read a ton and listened to a ton about it is because, you know, I think that one of the magical things about woodwinds and brass instruments is that, like, quite literally, that's how you're creating the music. And so it's much more apparent how critical breath is. Like, I don't have to tell you why it's valuable. You already know. For a lot of athletes, though, you know, maybe swimmers are tuned into this because oftentimes their breath has to be in rhythm with when their head's outside the water. You know, firefighters that I've worked with, because their SCBA only has a certain amount of oxygen, they've thought about how they're breathing and how they're consuming that resource. But for a lot of athletes and performers, this flies totally under the radar as a way of building capacity and then being ready and resilient. And it's just it's the only thing we can do. It's the only skeletal muscle, the diaphragm, that interfaces directly with our autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system is something that it's right there in the name. It's mostly automatic. And so our breathing rate impacts everything from heart rate to the balance of hormones in our body and how our fight or flight and rest and digest system relate to each other. And so that trickles down to affect our energy usage at a muscular level. It affects the way that we have access to our attention, right? It triggers certain brain circuits and predisposes us to pay attention to threats or potential threats as opposed to paying attention to what's most productive. And so when I think about how much you can move the needle with your breathing simply by deciding to put your hands on the wheel and breathing on purpose, it's staggering. And it's something that I will beat the drum for over and over again because it's such low-hanging fruit. We're all doing it. You can't leave home without it, right? It's right there. And so, you know, that's a long preamble to say then that what I do with a lot of my athletes, excuse me, they're not my athletes, the athletes that I work with and performers, is try and empower them to build that literacy and then the intelligence. And then we want to train for fitness. And what that means is that I don't want you to be trying a certain type of breathing for the first time minutes before you go out for your first playoff game. And if that's where we're at, then we've put ourselves at a tremendous disadvantage because you do what you do more of. And so if the only thing you've trained is not breathing well, that's the thing that's going to show up under pressure. And so we need to work backwards from that and think with purpose, what are we trying to accomplish? Are we trying to balance those two nervous system branches? Well, in that case, we're looking for between 4 and 7 breaths a minute with a fairly balanced inhale and exhale, but we want to be using the diaphragm. Right? So still the belly breath instead of the chest breath. Are we trying to downregulate? Are you trying to turn up the parasympathetic nervous system and create that state of relaxation and letting go of muscle tension? Well, then we want to bias towards the exhale. You want a longer exhale than inhale. And you want to use your nose, not your mouth, but you still want to use your belly. And we want to train that in quiet, calm environments first so that you can understand what the rhythm feels like and then feel that shift in nervous system, right? This is something that you can feel, is that downshift from, I didn't realize I was actually just a little crispy. Even though it didn't feel like I was stressed out, it was just kind of hanging around in the background. And then boom, 4 seconds in, 8 seconds out, or for some people it's 5-7 or whatever. You know, some people go as far as like 6-12 and now they're only breathing the roughly 3 times a minute. Right? And everybody's got different lungs and different diaphragms. So it's not about a specific prescription so much as it is empowering folks to say, here's the tools. Now let's train it for this purpose and figure out how you can get to relaxation. All right, if we're trying to work for balance, let's train and figure out what you need as an individual to get to balance. And then if we're trying to upregulate, if you're getting ready to do your PR on a power lift, or you're getting ready to run 100 meters and you need to just get amped, well, how do we need to breathe for that too? Because you can do that too, but you have to be able to practice that. And so from a performance standpoint, it is the first line of offense and defense. From a life standpoint, it is the opportunity to bring yourself to the present moment, unlock that capacity to be with the people around you. It's the opportunity to tell your body that you're safe right now, and that email that you just got from a colleague, coworker, or boss isn't going to kill you. I mean, full disclosure, the first date that I went on when I got to Boston, I sat in the car beforehand, and I have the HeartMath sensor that measures coherence, the connection of your breathing to your heart rate. And I sat and I breathed until I went green, and that my heart rate and my breathing rate were connected, just because it was like, all right, let me get to present and let me get to embodied. And now I can be my best self when it's time to step into that. So that's maybe more than you bargained for, but also certainly, I mean, we could do an entire episode on breathing alone, because it is that important.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you highlight how threaded it is into everything we do. And obviously it is, because it is part of our life system and cycle. But it's also, I guess I used to separate in terms of the way I think about my work and my life and my skill building. I used to separate physical, mental, emotional, and then professional sometimes. But I mean, I know they're all, like we said last time, it in one major web, but you can use the breath to build every single one of those pillars. And
absolutely,
in some ways that helps build skill in terms of trumpet playing. The breath offers the diaphragmatic support that you need to make a beautiful sound, but it's also a tool for calming yourself down. And it's also a tool for engaging your mental focus. And I really think and notice a huge difference when I do a breath activity and exercise before my first notes of the day. I notice how different everything is. And it's really, really, truly amazing. And I'm wondering if athletes do what I know brass players do, which is breath mapping. I plan out when I'm going to breathe where. And in my music, I have just little black tick marks where you're supposed to breathe. But when your nervous system is active and the adrenaline is running, of course, the respiratory system changes. And so where I need to take in oxygen is different than when I was practicing in a state of calm at home. And so then I have a red tick mark that I put in for emergency breaths that I may need when under pressure. But I have to practice both versions, and yeah, I have to sort of maybe run up and down the stairs before I'm doing a run through of a musical piece in order to give myself some sort of simulation of what it might feel like if I need to use the red tick marks in addition to the black ones. And I wonder if I find myself curious to know whether or not athletes, before they start a routine, if it's a routine sport, or before they go onto the court, like, is there a breath practice that is suggested, or am I just crazy? And do I think about it way more than everybody else?
I think that, again, important question. And for athletes, I think it maybe is a little bit different than, right, you're using your air to create the end product. And so maybe the sport that would connect to this would be somebody like a sport like swimming, where you certainly map your breathing to the strokes so that you can be in rhythm through the whole experience. And I'm thinking more of like the freestyle and breaststroke. I think backstroke, your head's out of the water from almost all of it. For other sports, though, you know, maybe some runners fall into a rhythm and they kind of know what that rhythm feels like in terms of the foot strike to breathing rhythm. But a lot of sports, it's going to vary wildly depending on the demands of the situation. And what we look for is the spaces between where you're able to take charge of your breathing. Because you don't, if you're playing defense in basketball, you don't want to have to be like, all right, breathe like this, instead of being engaged in the act of playing defense. And so during timeouts, when you're back on the bench grabbing a breather, can we be purposeful about breathing then so that you can rebalance your nervous system, you can conserve energy so that then you're free to go do what you've trained how to do when it's go time again? You know, same for, and maybe especially for hockey with how the lines roll, is that you're going to have an opportunity to sit on the bench and control your breathing so that you're prepared for the next 35 to 45 second shift and then right back to controlling your breathing. If you could get into the habit of doing that on purpose, right, you'd be in a really great position to have more energy in the tank by the time the experience was finished, right? You get to the end of the third period. The other thing that I love is that you are conscientious enough to recognize that you could practice being physiologically activated, right? So running up and down the stairs, doing a bunch of push-ups, burpees, sit-ups, squats, whatever it is. I mean, you could also pound six espressos. That there's a way to mirror not necessarily the pressure, but certainly the physiological activation that would allow you to see what it feels like to use those red tick marks and know that you can phrase things and express yourself effectively, even with a slightly different breathing map.
Yeah. I think the reason I find everything that you're saying so fascinating is because my single biggest paradigm shift of my career so far has been redefining what success looks like for me. Mm. And I was a head case in my youth, and it was black. My performance was either black or white. I was aiming for note perfect, which is not something I can really control because there are so many variables in any given performance. And sometimes people around you do something differently that, you know, knocks you off your focus or even keeps you in your focus, but your subconscious self knows something is different. And there's a million factors that could cause a brass player to miss a note. And so automatically I would feel like a failure once I started to miss notes. And then I tried to recalibrate the goals. And I was like, well, all right, well, then I'll let myself miss this many notes. But that wasn't the right strategy for redefining success, because then while I was performing, I was, and this is more of a competition mindset. This is when I was auditioning and trying to get win things. But I was then being aware of the mistakes I was actively making. So I would never be allowed to enter a state of flow or being in the zone because I was counting the number of mistakes.
Yeah.
Really unhealthy.
Well, at that point, it's the same game. You've just changed the bar.
Exactly. And then when I realized this, I was like, well, okay, so maybe I don't have control over the number of notes I miss because the way I feel in any given moment affects my accuracy. But what do I have control over? And then really resetting what success looks like for an audition. And one thing I did was I realized that my breathing gets all messed up when I'm really nervous. So I'm going to actively tell myself that I will be successful, or I will consider the audition a success if I just breathe for two full beats before the beginning of each phrase. That's it. And it was hard to do because I had trained my body into so much tension and into so much, trained my mind into such a weird space that just focusing on taking a two beat breath was really difficult for me to do. But once I trained it into myself, the success that I achieved was much greater. And then I heard somebody else say that as you exhale, imagine that your spine is growing taller. And that helped my performance in athletics. You know, I am training for a half marathon. I've run half marathons before. I've run a marathon. And I noticed that, not that I do this regularly or that it's a part of my regular training life, but I do notice when I'm focusing on the breath and actually focusing on my posture caused by the in and out motion of the air, it drastically affects my trumpet playing and also my physical performance in running.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you brought up a really good point when it comes to, and I think we get stuck with the process focus or outcome focus. And I think in mental training and sports psychology, this sort of gold standard is be process focused. And it's like a dirty word or a dirty thing to say to be like, well, I want to win, or I'm focused on being not perfect. And what you brought up here is that I think in general, focusing on the process or a part of the process frees you up to perform the way you know how to perform. And that the shift was away from how many can I be perfect? And then the downgraded, well, I'll give myself 5 mistakes or whatever the number was, to can I focus on a point of high leverage that is something that I have total control over that's going to give me the opportunity to perform at a higher level. Right. So when you were able to point out, let me just take 1 2-beat breath before I start every phrase. I mean, that's something you have total control over, right?
I should. Yeah.
No, the hope. And so is that going to guarantee your best performance? No. Is it going to put you in a position where you have the opportunity to then be present, embodied, and prepared to be fully engaged in the experience? I think it goes a long way. And so as much as I think there's some tension between this whole process outcome, and we sometimes to the detriment of the performer demand that they only pay attention to the process, I still think that's almost always the right way to go. And it's about finding the right part of the process to focus on. And really the metrics that I would use would be, do I have control over it? And is it something that's going to actually unlock my ability to perform at the highest level without any sort of transactional or contingent nature to it, right? So I can't be like, I'll only breathe for those 2 beats if I know that I'm about to crush that phrase. Because as soon as it gets transactional like that, now I'm still kind of stuck in a what looks like a process focus, but it's really an outcome focus. Mm-hmm. We've just put lipstick on the pig, I guess.
I like that image.
I mean, look, pigs deserve to look pretty too.
They don't already?
Oh, well, walked into that one. Whoops.
So speaking of trying to find a space for your mind, but also try not to be, to allow it to be a transactional space. There's something I've heard a lot, and it usually highlights a not so profound teacher. When a teacher says to a student, well, just don't think about that, or just let go and play, or just go with the flow. You know, they're trying to tell me or students where to place their mind. And while the intention is good, maybe the tools aren't given to help said student actually go with the flow. So what does it mean? Yes. How do you go with the flow? What does that mean? And how do you train yourself to embody what the coach or teacher is asking for? Because I think that's a huge barrier between good and great.
And the thing that's so frustrating is that now I'm thinking that the end goal that I need is a clear mind. That I just let my mind go blank, or I just let go and play. And I'm now aiming at a target that, one, is totally impractical. And two, is, I think, impossible. And so now I'm just going to be more frustrated, and I'm going to be more convinced that other people have it and I don't. And those two things together make it way less likely that I'm going to rehearse and practice effectively and then be able to transition those into a pressure-packed performance. You know, I think that there's a, out of acceptance and commitment therapy, there's an example that demonstrates how just absolutely futile it is to try and not think. And the example is pretty straightforward. Somebody puts a gun to your head and says, don't think for the next 5 seconds or I'm going to shoot you. What do? You're going to think. You don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And so there's an illusion of control about our thinking that puts us in a position where every time we can't control our thinking, we feel like we're somehow a failure. What makes it worse is that people at the top of the mountain don't always have the language to explain what they're doing. And so they might describe it as clearing their mind or going blank. And now we're going like, well, okay, that person can do it. And I want to be more like that person. So all that is to say that your mind is filled, your mind, my mind, every mind listening to this is filled with thoughts always. And this was one of the most important things that came out of my first meditation retreat was like, they are always there and they are in multitudes. I mean, the volume of thought, not just noise, but also just quantity of thoughts is staggering. The only reason that's not a problem is because when we're not paying attention to what's going on in our mind, it's not distracting. And so I sometimes talk about them like the noisy neighbors upstairs or the noisy little cousins in the attic. It's like, well, you tune out white noise all the time. And so if something's going on in between your ears that isn't pulling your attention from the task at hand, what's actually important now, then it might feel like your mind has gone blank, or it might feel like you've been able to just let go and play. But what's really happening here and what we can now train on purpose is how to get your mind and your attention. So your eyes and then the part of your awareness that exists behind your eyes, right? So wherever your mind's eye is, where can we put those that's going to be effective if it's not on the thoughts that you're thinking? Because if we can do that, then it doesn't really matter what's happening inside your mind. You could be thinking about having thoughts about breakfast, lunch, or dinner. You could be thinking about the last time you screwed up. But as soon as you transition your attention back to what's important now, none of that's a big deal. The only part of the big deal is that we generally go, oh no, I can't have that thought. And as soon as I do that, I'm now hooked by that thought. And there goes my clear mind, right? And I'm wondering if all of that fits for you or if I've just gone off the deep end.
No, it fits perfectly. It's like the more meta you go, the more danger you get yourself in.
Especially, you know, if you want to think of, you got two images here we could go with, either the diving into the ocean or, you know, floating out from the space station. Either way, if you don't have the tether to get back, that's a problem. But otherwise, if you have the skill that allows you to go meta and think all the thoughts and really dig in, if you catch yourself having an unproductive thought like right before you take that 2-beat breath, but if you have the tether to get back, it's no big deal. It's just another thought in the thousands of millions of thoughts that exist in between your ears that don't have to be a big deal. It's only when we don't have the capacity to trace that tether back and to do it quickly to get us back to the point at hand, to be present and purposeful with permission to do our best work, it's only then that it becomes an issue. And that's something that I target and try and train really early on with the performers I work with, because I think that there's a master key in there somewhere around shifting the relationship to your mind so that you're no longer sitting there going like, everybody else has a blank mind and I don't, and there must be something wrong with me.
Yeah. The few times I've tried to perform with a blank mind. Oh, a blank mind also means that you just don't care about anything. So yeah, I can't remove the care I have for my performance. And if I do, I perform pretty terribly.
Yeah.
I know. I've been there.
Because me too.
Well, one time I was paid not with money, but with beer for an Oktoberfest gig. You know, the more beer you have, the less you care. And my goodness, my performance was not good that day.
Yeah, it is one way to get to free. Although your freedom to perform at that point is probably interfered with your motor skill capacity once you've crossed a certain threshold.
Well, it is. It is interesting. So, some musicians, I'm thinking of like Chet Baker is a great example. Drugs and alcohol are a big part of certain musical artistic pockets. And for me, I cannot perform even having had one beer or a half a beer. Well, the half a beer makes me feel tired and lethargic, so I'm just not that interested. But the one time I did a gig where I was paid in beer, I mean, I was doing a gig with my friends. It was not just me playing solo, but we're doing polkas for a Oktoberfest gig.
Amazing.
Yeah, pretty fun, right? And polkas are almost always in the same key. So, there was a point where I was on a totally different song. I was on a different polka than my group, and none of us noticed until we got to the B section. Because we were all in the same key and that's how impaired we were. But there was some freedom because of the, maybe another way to use the word crispy, the crispiness of my general approach to trumpet at that time in my studies. Mm. The crispiness left and there was more of an easy bodied flow, but it turned into quicksand and pretty quickly it goes the other way where it's just no longer fun because it's not there. That element of challenge, that reaching for that 4%, was no longer there because it was impaired. So I doubt athletes have that issue, but it's a big part of musical culture. Unfortunately, is drugs and alcohol, especially some certain cultures more than others, but.
Yeah, I think that it's a valuable conversation to have because it illuminates, regardless of how you're adjusting your state, there is a center to the bullseye, which is what I define as ready, right? So where we want to be at the start of the performance, you want to be in the center of the bullseye. And we're thinking about, at least I'm thinking about that interaction between alert and focused. There's alert enough, there's focused enough, there's such thing as too focused, right? I'm too narrow and I'm too kind of through that very, very tight beam of the spotlight and I'm missing all the other important stuff. And then there's certainly, too cranked up, right? But the opposite's true, right? I'm thinking of my golfer friends, sometimes a beer helps you get a little bit more physically relaxed. Right? And it allows you to then let go a little bit because maybe you're just thinking too much about the outcome and I hit that bad shot and now that's going to mean a bad round. And so it's just free enough to drop you into the center of the bullseye. Right? But then I have a few friends and who, if one beer is good, three beers is better. And now all of a sudden I've overshot the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what it means is, or a lot of what it comes down to is how do you understand and explain your state, your physiology, and what's going on with your psychology. Because for some people, I've read enough biographies of musicians now to know that some of them would just go out and get blasted, and that they go out and perform amazingly, and it unlocks whatever creative space that they have the opportunity to go to, but they're interpreting that intoxication in a way that's theoretically getting them closer to the center of the bullseye. Whereas if somebody else was to engage in that same pre-performance routine, they would interpret the physiological experience and the psychological experience and go, nope, this is not how I operate. And so I want to be clear, because my imaginary lawyer is hovering over my shoulder, that I'm not advocating for, and I don't think you're advocating for, using any sort of intoxicant to arrive at ready and resilient. And, even for folks who use caffeine leading up to a performance, right? That's an outside, not an intoxicant, but it's something you are using to affect your nervous system, theoretically to find the center of the bullseye, although you might overshoot it. Six espressos is probably, four espressos too many. And so I think it, it brings up a valuable under the surface conversation of, well, how are you arriving at the center of the bullseye? And is that effective? Is it sustainable? Are you using it as a crutch? And all of the things that come with that.
It also allows for the next question in your preparation, which is, if you are one of those people who finds having 3 beers or 4 beers allows you to enter this uninhibited state that you maybe are defining as your bullseye right now, it allows you to ask the question, why? And what do you not get when you're sober that this seemingly gives you, that this alcohol seemingly gives you? And so I think it's an opportunity to unlock something in sobriety that you're not allowing yourself to have. Some sort of freedom.
I think that, you know, just like I'm not advocating for, I'm also not trying to pass judgment on whoever is out there doing whatever it is they're doing, as long as they're not doing long-term harm to themselves. And I'll be totally honest. The last time I experienced flow on stage, I was asked to sit in for just one song with two phenomenal musicians, both fiddle players, and I was like super intimidated because I can play guitar, but I don't crush it. And I knew that they were much better musicians than I was. And they had asked me to play a song that I didn't, it was like a finger picking tune, and I just kind of gotten that under my belt. And so they also didn't tell me when they were going to call me up. So then it just became a, hey, hang out and see what happens and we'll call you up when. And so now I'm waiting. And I'm kind of marinating in all of that, like, I'm going to have to go up there soon. And now I'm thinking about, like, well, I'd love to do really great and this is going to be awesome, but what if I biff it? And we were at a brewery. And so I went and I ordered a beer. Mm-hmm. And it just happened that the beer that I was interested in ordering was like an 11 or 12% Imperial Stout. And I drank it slowly. Right? But I would not say that I was 100% sober. I just... maybe just a little, like 2 or 3% looser than I would have been. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did I need it? No. Was it, and in the end, the thing that, along with all of the other conditions, allowed me to step in between the two of them and then proceed to just have a magical experience. I was very much in flow. Yeah, maybe that was part of it. Mm-hmm. And did it mean that the next time I got on stage, I made sure to go get an Imperial Stout? No. And it gave me at least a blueprint for what I could feel like so that I could then engineer that into something that's much more controllable and not left up to chance, like having a drink before you go play your music.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic because abuse is heavy in this topic, obviously, not only in sports or in music, but everywhere. I lost my thought. What was I going to say? I lost it.
It's in there somewhere.
It's in there. Oh, yeah. This kind of relates. Somebody once told me that our best performances and our worst performances are often closer together than we think. And what feels like a good performance and what feels like a bad performance from a bystander perspective often doesn't look that or sound that different. It's just how we feel about it given the context of when, where, how that performance happened. And I obviously in certain activities, it's a little more black and white. You either made the field goal or you didn't, but you still own the skills that you own. And when it comes to performing a piece of music, I might be upset about those 4 notes that I missed and that one passage that I worked really hard on that didn't come out. But what the audience may have felt is totally different. And oftentimes when I record myself, I realize that, oh, there's something unattractive in the playing that I'm offering that has nothing to do with what I was worried about with in performance. And I wonder if you experience that, or if you have any relatability to that.
I remember a conversation with a colleague, shout out to Mac, that she said, you know, a lot of continuums aren't a straight line. They're a horseshoe. And so the extremes on either end are actually far closer together than all the stuff that kind of happens in the middle. And so I immediately saw that image when you started sharing that. And I think it's true for certain experiences and certain types of continuums. It's not true for some others, right? But the other thing that I'm thinking of as you share that is the fact that we're essentially knitting together our understanding of experience as it's happening, and that we then go back and we kind of rehash or re-explain some parts of it, sort of post-mortem, right? But that a lot of times the way that we're knitting together experience on the fly is what stands. That initial experience of this felt like that, or maybe it felt like this. It was good or it was bad. I nailed it or I didn't, is really so contingent on the reaction of the people around you to the experiences you've had like it in the past that give you a cue for how to interpret what's happening. And this is why I think novel experience, being in some place for the first time or competing in a way that you've never have before, or playing a piece of music for the first time in front of an audience, you know, we don't have as much of a blueprint. And so there's a little bit more beginner's mind that is built into the experience. And that it's valuable to recognize that initial knitting together of this means this because, that connecting cause and effect that our brain, our mind is doing automatically all day, that it doesn't have to actually be true. And that we have the opportunity to go back, like we talked about earlier with reflection, go back and be purposeful about how we're connecting the dots, as opposed to letting usually what's our slightly less developed parts of our brain decide for us, was that good or bad? Did it feel nice or did it feel crappy? Because mm-hmm. That's not always a great indicator of whether or not we are in the center of the bullseye. And it's also not, especially for music and other art modalities, it's not a great indication of whether or not the audience walked away changed. And I feel that when I do workshops or am in front of a group for any reason, it's not for me. I don't need to walk out feeling great for me to have moved the needle. And sometimes I'm actually preventing myself from making impact because I'm busy trying to make sure that I feel like I'm the champion when I walk out of there. And so really clarifying, what are you trying to do? And then who are you trying to do that with or to? Mm-hmm. I think ends up being really important.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like that. And somewhat relatedly, how you interact and engage with the people you're either trying to help or work with also comes back to your individual component and your individual experience. And I remember making the analogy when I was transitioning from trying to be the best, but the word best is kind of an undefinable word. What does that actually even mean? I had no clear picture of what I was going towards and what I wanted to sound like and my personal expressive qualities. And I realized that I was trying to build skyscrapers instead of a mosaic. And I was trying to just have this visual facade that's really impressive without substance. And if I build a mosaic, it's more of this fluid spectrum of skills that I throw together. And because of the way I put them together, they're beautiful. And that really helped me help other people to not think so in such a binary way. So I feel like maybe that's a little bit of a departure from what you were saying, but for some reason, what you said reminded me of that.
Well, what I love is that it was an example of how you've knitted together the meaning of your past experience. And so when someone says, how do you define success? You have now this network within your mind and therefore your brain that is suddenly triggered. And now you get the image of a skyscraper versus a mosaic. And you think about what your experience had been like and probably feel some of the feelings that came with that binary black and white way of defining success. And you have this richness and this depth that we probably could describe as wisdom that you can now impart to a certain extent, right? You can't force feed people wisdom, but you can certainly say, as someone who's traveled up that route of the mountain, you know, watch out for the scree and the mudslide over there. You maybe want to pick a different way up the mountain because I tried this and it didn't feel great and didn't get me all the way to the top.
Yeah. You know, do you know Brené Brown?
Oh, I love Brené Brown. Let's go.
literally this morning, took her wholehearted inventory. I guess you'd call it a quiz. It's an inventory, she calls it. And that also helped me clarify, redefine, and reframe my goals, what I'm going for and what I'm aiming for. And I love the parameters that the I'm doing air quotes, the results get you, which is you have basically a tank and it's either, you know, it's on some spectrum of being full. And when you're, you know, for example, there's two words in your results. There's or two sets, letting go of ... or cultivating ... And you're somewhere on the spectrum in between those. And so, for example, what people think versus authenticity, you know, and I score somewhere in the 50, right down the middle of like, I'm letting go of what people think so that I can cultivate authenticity. And I just love the way she delivers the results to help redefine the goal and the aim. And I think that's so important. I'm speaking from a point of being a musician in the arts and cultivating authenticity so you can share your expressive self with people and not trying to be what you think people want you to be. But I'm sure it applies to every arena of life.
Every aspect of performance, certainly. And I think it echoes out to how we live our lives. And so that balance of, you know, like the social fabric demands that we, on some level, care what other people think, because otherwise we'd all just go out and do whatever our basic lowest level brain says, which is feel good, don't feel bad. And so there's a certain amount of the people that we care about and the or institutions that we're a part of, you know, not going all the way off the reservation. And at the same time, too much of that is constricting and trying to be someone else puts you at a severe disadvantage from start to finish. I couldn't recommend The Gifts of Imperfection, which is, I think it was Brené's first book, which is where I believe the wholehearted inventory emerged from. Mm-hmm. And I'll have a link because you can take it online. I'll have a link to that because I think that her way of framing the soft and squishy, vulnerability, courage, shame, and how that plays out, not to be, you know, butterflies and rainbows and all of that, but instead to be the best self you can be in both life and performance. She does a wonderful job of framing and then walking that line so that it's accessible to anyone and it's highly impactful. Mm. If you haven't read some of her other books too, I could continue to go down the rabbit hole. I think she's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think where this applies is I'm really interested in setting up practice procedures so that I can arrive at ready and find my bullseye. And I think by taking this inventory, I realize that I am structuring some of my preparation in ways to that aren't serving what I'm cultivating. They're serving a fear. I'm worried that I'm not going to do X. So I'm putting it into my preparation and I'm taking a fear approach. And so I like the idea of building a practice and a preparation process based around what I'm trying to cultivate instead of what I'm worried about. And that circles back to intention and having a very clear next step based off of reflection and wisdom and experience.
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on there. And I go back and forth with this, and so I'm curious what you think. I think fear is a phenomenal motivator. And I hesitate sometimes to pull that out from underneath a performer. However, I'll qualify it before I let you weigh in. It's rocket fuel that damages the vessel as you use it. So, I mean, I love Fast and the Furious, and I'm not ashamed to say it. And so it'd be like using the NOS. Like, you can only use so much of that before your car falls apart. Your engine can't take it. And so you got to be really particular about it. And so I think that fear has a place, and it needs to be on purpose and very sparing. And I wonder where you land on that.
I think fear can be beautiful depending on what you're scared of. And,
ooh, yeah,
you know, when it comes to, for example, authenticity, or the other side of that coin, which is what people think. If I'm scared of what people think about me, I think that fear is very dangerous. But if I'm scared to not be authentic, or to squish my expressive nature in any way, that's a valid fear and a beautiful one, and one that should give me some fuel to put practices in place to avoid caging my authenticity. So I guess it's just taking, first of all, being aware of the fear, sitting inside of it for a little bit, and then looking under the rug and asking what exactly is triggering the fear. And is it from a wholehearted place, or is it maybe from a scarcity space?
That is so elegant.
Which brings me to another question for you. I know we're probably running low on time, but how does mental health weave its way into your work?
Do you have another 3 hours? I think that it actually relates really closely to what we're just talking about, is that mental well-being and mental health, mental fitness is the foundation of sustainable, optimal performance. And the reason why it relates to what we're talking about is that you can get away with not taking good care of your mental health, of not training mental well-being, of not seeking out support when there are things that are beyond your capacity to navigate yourself, that you can get away with that. And a lot of athletes and performers do until they don't. And so it's a crack in the foundation, and you just can't build too much on top of that. Eventually the skyscraper is going to collapse. And the hope is that it doesn't do that before athletes and performers recognize that there's value to looping back around. And it may mean stepping backwards in terms of your capacity to perform. It may mean stepping away from your sport for a period of time. And fortunately, we've seen more and more high profile athletes who have noticed that there's an unsustainable nature to what they're doing, who have then stepped away. They've built a new foundation or repaired the foundation in terms of taking care of their basic needs and anything else that might be coming up that's interfering with their capacity to, from their head down, live in a healthy, happy way. And then reemerge and reengage their sport afterwards, because that's the only way to sustain the amount of practice and the amount of energy and the amount of emotion and both love and fear you have to pour into something to be excellent. And so, although my work is not directly mental health related, I think that it serves a potentially preventative purpose. And I always bring it back to physical, because it that's so much more tangible. And so if you're taking care of yourself by lifting and engaging in some resistance training so that you can be strong, but you're also engaging in some flexibility or mobility training so that you're not losing range of motion, and you're doing all of that in a intelligent, structured way, your body is going to be more resilient. It's less likely to break down when you put it under high demand. Now, again, it's an ongoing practice. You don't get to just go to the gym, go like, all right, I'm strong now, and then stop. You have to maintain that fitness. And I think the same is true for what goes on with our mind, that the mental training that I engage in can put you in a position where you can handle a higher volume of stressful experience without necessarily putting yourself in a position where you have to step away from your sport or step away from your performance. And flat out, as far as I'm concerned, everyone should have a counselor or psychologist. Mm-hmm. Right? We all have teachers to teach us math, and we all have teachers back in the day who taught us history and English and everything else, except for like what on earth is going on between our ears, which is just so stinking complicated. And so to have an unbiased party who is trained to listen and then has the theoretical foundation to be like, you didn't know this, but what happened to you happens to a lot of people, and here's what you might try. I think flat out, that would be, if I could wave a magic wand, that would change the foundation, which would allow us to be more solid when it's time to pursue the stuff we love, whether it's athletics or arts or whatever captures our passion. Mm-hmm. Oof. That wasn't 3 hours, but that's the prelude to everything else.
Right. Yeah. And I care so deeply about budding performers. Not necessarily just in budding musicians, but I remember that fear of being young and deciding I really want to go for it and wondering, can I do it? Am I good enough? You know, this is not, my family doesn't do music. It's not a safe, quote, a safe career path, according to my young mind at that time. But one thing I'm positive about is that when I'm 60 or 70, I don't think I will look back on my life and regret spending a decade mastering an art form, or in other cases, mastering a physical skill or a sport or anything that you really commit to, because you learn so much about yourself and about building procedures along the way. And so I always tell incoming students, you really only need to maintain two things in order to be successful: your mental and physical health and your ability to grow. And then no matter what, you're going to be successful if you can do those two things. And I loved listening to Amy Kimball's interview where she was talking about, you know, need-based preparation and how she at one point was thinking of leaving the field and then discovered a totally new branch of the field, and just like allowing yourself to stumble into these new spaces, and allowing yourself to leave certain spaces that aren't serving you. If you close a door because it's not a sustainable room that you're in, I think the opportunities of other doors to open are enormous. And it's so fun for me to hear other people's stories and to hear how that happened to them.
I was going to try and be eloquent, but you just put the nail on the head. And I love the clarity behind your physical and mental well-being and your capacity to grow. And my hope is that the work that I do in performance is really just a Trojan horse, because I find that people, because there's so much passion behind and striving towards something within the context of performance, that they're willing to do stuff that they might not be willing to do if it was just like, hey, this is preventative and going to allow you to live a happier, healthier life. Oh, I'll do that later.
Right.
But like, if I tell somebody that this is going to make them better in practice tomorrow, like, I will practice breathing, hopefully, most of the time.
Right. Yeah.
And so my hope is that everybody I interact with is going to walk away with more capacity to be happy and healthy. Mm-hmm. And that's not happy all the time. I I want to clarify that it's not whitewashing the down stuff, because it's just not the way it works. You have to experience the ups and the downs. The goal is to move through those with the skills and the support so that you don't hang out in the lows for a long time and then disregard the highs. Mm-hmm. And if I can do that in the context of sport and performance, my hope is that we will live in a world that has more people who are capable of being happy and healthy mm-hmm. on the whole.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I will start by listening to your podcast and continuing to do so because it really is a nice, it's an amazing way to check in with finding happiness and health through the vessel of goal setting in whatever skill you're trying to develop.
Is this the part where you make me feel uncomfortable because you're giving me compliments?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Oof. All right. I'll breathe through it. I'll breathe with it.
Use your skills. Use your skills.
Gene, thank you so much for stepping into what was not a super planned out thing. It was just, I handed the reins over and you absolutely crushed it. And I had a blast having the conversation. I hope that you enjoyed getting to drive the bus. And I hope the folks that are listening got a whole lot out of it as well.
Thanks for having me. It was a really fun, new, slightly vulnerable experience for me as well.
That's a wrap. First off, thank you for listening. This project is a labor of love, and I hope you're enjoying these conversations as much as I am. An important note, everything you hear here reflects my own views and opinions and that of my guests and has no relationship to any of my other professional roles or responsibilities. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe to the show and don't forget to rate and leave a review. Also, if you want to dive deeper into the concepts and concrete practices from today, I'm talking about access to show notes and the transcript from the episode and a whole bunch of other mental training goodies, head over to mtl.academy. That's mtl.academy. Until next time, be well.